Unborn babies may kick their mother 30 times an hour, making moms wonder, is there a karate champion in there? Well, one thing she won't wonder about is finding a great doctor at one of our 65 convenient Bay Area locations. Stanford Medicine Children's Health.
Honey, Bobby might get strep throat this season. Does sometime after Thanksgiving work for you?
Some things you just can't plan.
Sorry, November's bad. I have Maddie scheduled for the flu.
That's why we built a network of Stanford pediatricians conveniently located all over the Bay Area. And while you can't always plan for when your kids need to see their doctor...
Mom, is it okay if I get pink eye next week?
It's nice to know we're close by. Stanford Medicine Children's Health. Access to excellence. Visit stanfordchildrens.org to find a pediatrician.
Psst! How'd you like to listen to .NET Rocks with no ads? Easy. Become a patron. For just $5 a month, you get access to a private RSS feed where all the shows have no ads. $20 a month will get you that and a special .NET Rocks patron mug. Sign up now at patreon.dotnetrocks.com.
Hey, welcome back to .NET Rocks. I'm Carl Franklin.
And I'm Richard Gamble.
And this is show 1920.
There you go.
And Chris Sells, we can see him. You can't see him, but he just shook his head like, how did that happen?
How
he was on
happen?
Episode 10. Well, anyway, 1920 was a leap year starting on Thursday of the Gregorian calendar and a leap year starting on Wednesday of the Julian calendar, the 1920th year of the Common Era and Anno Domini designations, the 920th year of the second millennium, the 20th year of the 20th century, and the first year of the 1920s decade, of course. Don't you feel old? Nice.
It's also when the League of Nations got formed.
Ah, are there any other trivial details you want to say about 1920, Richard?
Women got the vote in the United States.
You're amazing.
I don't
we didn't even practice this.
No.
He just looked up to the sky. Yeah, here's a factoid.
Pretty sure it's 1920, yeah. Pretty sure.
Wow. Amazing. All right. As we said, Chris Sells is coming up here. I know you're interested and anxious to hear from him. But first, we have this little thing called Better Know Framework.
Awesome. All right, man. What do you got?
Simon Kropp sent me this. It's not his, but github.com/auto-dark-mode /Windows Auto Night Mode.
So night mode versus dark mode?
Well, yeah. So the whole idea is that it goes to dark mode at night.
Right.
And then light mode in the daytime. Now, I work in a room with no windows.
Right.
I am dark mode all the time, and I like it that way.
Yeah, sure.
But I know there are people that, you know, do work out in the daylight, such as you, Richard.
Yeah, I got natural light coming in.
Yeah. And you might, you know, you get this feature in phones, right? And it goes to dark mode automatically. Why not for Windows?
Yeah. Why shouldn't it be in your PC?
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, that's a good idea.
Yeah. So if that's the kind of thing you like, there you go. Know it, learn it, love it. 1920.pwop.me.
Awesome.
Who's talking to us today, Richard?
Grabbed a comment off of show 1898, the one we did with our friend Sean Wildermuth. Earlier this year, 2024, on being a senior software developer, which I would argue kicked off the largest chains of conversation so far this year.
And isn't it interesting that he was like a little concerned that it might not go over well?
And it's like, this is not an important show. It's like, I think you're wrong.
Yeah.
But and he also didn't know that I had Aaron Erickson coming on the following week, which the Nomadic developer, same age, a little different career
different
style.
Story.
So I thought it was a good comparison and just ability to tell that show.
Great
anyway,
show.
I thought one of these comments would fit really nicely with where we're going to end up going, clearly being three old guys talking on a show. This is from Smitty, who said, I am about to turn 60 and have been a professional developer for 38 years. I just discovered this website and podcast as a result of the show that Richard does with Therat, that'd be Windows Weekly. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I saw an interview with Sean, who I knew from Pluralsight, and I gave it a listen, and I really enjoyed it. I've gone through this phase a couple of times, this sort of what am I doing with my career phase, which I think was where Sean was at the time, and I'm in it again. For the last 15 years, I've been working my way up through management and currently in upper management. The money is great. And as mentioned in the episode, my value is the wisdom that I've accrued over the decades. Mm. It is useful in my department of 40 plus developers and directors. These days, my question is, when do I retire? 5 to 7 years? And what do I do after that? I just don't see myself sitting in a rocker on a front porch anytime soon.
Yep.
Yeah, I know it. You know, if you stop, you're going to die, right? We're sharks here. You need to keep moving. But yeah.
Seriously, though, you guys are different. Obviously, maybe Chris isn't. But if I don't write code, at least, you know, several hours a week, I feel like, why am I even on this planet?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And I realize is, like, I don't own a project per se, but I'm always writing bits of code for things.
Yeah.
A lot of it is home automation these days, but it's still, you know, you're always trying to solve problems with code because you can.
Because I can, yeah.
Yeah. But let's face it, there's so many more things to do. I'm getting ready to build another machine, and the conversation with the local community spun into, hey, would you build that machine at the high school?
Right.
You know, do a session with everyone, just to walk them through building a machine. So I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Like, these are things you could do any point in your life.
That's right. And, yeah. And there's more so time many ways for to it contribute. Later.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, Smitty, thank you so much for your comment. And a copy of Music Code By is on its way to you. And if you'd like a copy of Music Code By, write a comment on the website at .NETROCKS.com or on the Facebooks. We publish every show there. And if you comment there and I read it on the show, we'll send you a copy of Music Code By.
And Music to Code By is still going strong. People are buying it, and which is great. And I'm thinking about fixing to come up with a new one.
You're not just fixing to go.
Fixing for...
fixing to write.
Yeah, for 22. Track number 22.
You were saying in an earlier show that you were listening to it and it sort of triggered some things in your head, right?
Yeah, I was like, you know, this isn't quite half bad. And, you know, I was only worried that I was listening to it as music and not as background stuff, but it still did the trick. Well, let's bring on Chris Sells. Chris is an advocate for developers, a Flutter fanatic, and a consultant in applied AI and developer tools and ecosystems. Now retired, he enjoys long walks on the beach and various technologies. And I do not think he is looking for another wife, right? I know that long walks on the beach thing kind of triggered that thought.
Yeah. Also, guest on episode 10, which was like the definitive description of garbage collection.
Yes.
In 2002.
And episode 100 and several episodes after that. But
like more than a dozen.
A lot of things have happened since episode 10.
I can't believe you're at episode 1920. Are you kidding me? It's now you're into like the 20th century, right? Yes. These are like years. And of course, that's what you did, right? You went, hey, you know, what happened in 1920? And you forgot Prohibition, which seems like a bad idea.
Yeah.
The ACLU was formed, which is a good idea.
Absolutely. And
I didn't know this. I'm sure, Richard, you did. That Ponzi schemes were named after a man named Charles Ponzi. And he did it in 1920.
Wow.
I think the bigger aesthetic around 1920 is you're coming out of World War I and the Spanish flu. Hmm. And so culturally, there was this sense of what we now call existentialism. It's like everybody knew somebody who had died. And for random reasons, the first industrialized war, this disease we didn't understand. You know, at this point, Pasteur's figured out what brewer's yeast is, but that's about it. We're still 20 years away from antibiotics and any treatments for a lot of these things. You still had children that died from stepping on a nail, right? And so the fact that you had this insanity happen over the previous 5-8 years, this is where the whole flapper movement comes from, where a lot of this stuff comes from. It's like, party today, because today is live.
Hey, save this for subsequent shows.
Yeah, the roaring 20s.
This is it.
We have a lot of shows to get through.
Yeah, so these are the shows. These are your roaring 20s, your shows. So
yes.
We're going to do, it's 1920, and we're going to roar through them, because many good stories about this.
I am happy to be your first flapper on your 1920s era of shows.
All right. So what have you been up to, Mr. Sells?
Yeah.
Retirement, you said before the show.
Well, it's funny. I did the math, in June, my birthday,
Mm-hmm.
And I have been a full-time software engineer for about 40 years at that point. And wow. Yes, if you do the math, I actually started with an Apple II Plus in my parents' basement when I was about 14. And they made me go to high school during the day, but all the rest of the time, I was writing code.
Yeah.
And I've been
6502 assembler.
It was not. Oh, I did some of that, right? I would
indexed indirect addressing for anyone.
I remember
really
entering the strings of 6502 just by as numbers, as poke statements, right? Yeah. From magazines. And so for Christmas one year, I asked my grandmother to buy me a speech synthesis card for my Apple II Plus, which she had no idea what that was, but you know, she, I helped her track it down, and I used it to read back to me the listings that I entered from the magazine to make sure that I got everything right. Because, you know, you drop one number.
So instead of going eyes back and forth, you're literally hearing it say it and you're reading against the magazine.
That's right.
I love it.
Yeah. And yeah, so a Swedish farmer was reading me back my code listings to make sure that I entered them correctly.
You're not going to believe this, but I my first computer at home was a TRS-80 Model 4. Mm-hmm. I know I'm like the young kid in the crowd, right, in terms of computers. But I also bought a speech synthesis card that you could attach to the back of it. Mm-hmm. And I used it to play games with my friends where I taught my friend how to enter in an input statement for a particular person that we knew. And then it would spit out, you know, a time warp. Now, what happened? Like the game was you woke up in the future and you have a computer here and you want to ask it what happened to, and you put in a name and then it read back a paragraph. And we would spend hours just writing up these crazy paragraphs and the thing would speak it back to us. And just these insane stories.
We talk about, you know, our first computers. Ed, Richard, I hope you'll tell us what yours is in a minute. But
TRS-80 Model 1.
There you go. The Trash 80, the Apple II Plus, right? Yeah. I mean, a friend of mine who had a VIC 20. I mean, I think anyone listening to the show is going to think we're born in the 1920s.
Yeah. Apparently the TRS-80, I didn't learn this till years later when I got smitten with history, that the Tandy company did not think it was going to do well. So they only manufactured like 2,000 of them and distributed one to each store.
Hmm.
And that's all there was. and they just sort of sat in the corner. And I was the kid at 10 who, this is 1970. So, and I went in and I could make it work and they didn't care, right? That I could make it work. They weren't doing anything with it. So I had to find time messing around with a whole 4K of RAM.
Right.
But it also then became a sales tool, right? Like when people did get interested and wanted to buy it, the fact that the 10-year-old was making it sing and dance, sure. Like, you can do this.
Yeah, they didn't realize you weren't just any 10-year-old, right? So,
yeah,
but still, I guess it was nice for the store.
But I was in a Radio Shack in the first place because I was buying parts for making stuff go boom. I wanted a rocket countdown timer because saying 3, 2, 1 is too much work for me, right? I want to push a button and it counts down for me.
And for me, I did the same thing, Richard, and I've told this story before, except I was kind of a jokester. So I go into Radio Shack where they had the Tandys running, and I would press Control C to break out of the basic program that was running, and I'd clear it and write my own basic program. And usually it ended up with swearing at the customer.
Inevitably, yeah.
10 print, Carl rules, 20 go to 10, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was more like, what's your name, $? And then F you, $?
Pretty simple.
Man. And just walk out. Yeah, I was a jerk, little kid. Anyway.
You were at Microsoft. Then was a long gap. I'm just thinking about shows. Then we did the Leet show with you, which was 1337. I mean, literally Leet.
Sure.
Which was the Google Cloud show, which I thought was really awesome, right? Sure. Talking about .NET on Google Cloud and all the goodness that still exists there. And then we certainly a lot of Flutter love, but you haven't been on the show since you left Google for Facebook. What was that about?
Yeah. What were you thinking? What was that about?
I'm pretty sure I phoned you at the time and go, dude, what are you doing?
Well, and I am not and have never been a Facebook user.
Right.
I was not a Facebook user when not being a before not being a Facebook user, user was cool.
Right.
That's right. And so when I interviewed with them, actually, it was funny. I'm like, just to be clear, I don't use Facebook. I don't know if that's a deal breaker or not. And they were fine, because at that point they had changed their name to Meta.
Meta.
Right. So that's how I would think about it. I went to work for Meta, and I went to work for Meta so I could work with my dear, dear friend, Don Boss.
Yeah. Okay. Fair. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was in Reality Lab. He was a VP there driving various AR and VR kinds of things. And so I was there doing dev tools for AR and VR developers for their, well, for their Quest headset now, right? Yeah. And then, you know, we were working on, and still, I'm sure they're still working on AR hardware, right? You know, more like glasses than goggles, right?
Yeah, sure, sure. Did you work on Horizon World?
No, I did not. Okay. I was working on the other side. I was working on the platform side. That was the one of the apps they were building.
Yeah, so they were implementing your, the tooling you were building was what helped build Horizon World, presumably.
You would, yeah. I mean, there was a platform of things, and we had actually a bunch of teams around Meta building various things. Obviously, Horizon World was one of the big clients for that platform, but a lot of building a lot of first party apps. The idea being, you know, what was the thing that developers needed to build for to build compelling VR apps,
right?
Apps, not games, right? The games thing they had locked down, and they still do.
Sure,
but apps at, or mixed reality apps or augmented reality apps, right? Yeah. What do you really need? And so
I thought Unity was that thing. In fact, I think you told me as much.
Well, so Unity was the what they used to build games for sure, and apps and experiences for virtual reality, right? Where you own all the pixels. Unity is great for that, and Meta had a partnership, and I'm sure it still does, with Unity. And you know, one of the outputs from the Unity IDE was, "Hey, I want to target something for the Quest." But when it comes to augmented reality, you know, the hardware you get on a pair of glasses, or the hardware they were projecting or dreaming of, right, was going to be a lot smaller. It's way too small to run something big like Unity,
right?
So
horsepower wise,
yeah. So we were looking for something, you know, much smaller, that you could, you know, get the performance and still build the experiences at the same time, inventing what those experiences would be.
Sure.
Right, what do people really want? What's the killer app, if you were, for your glasses, right?
So really what you're talking about is an app that you can run on the glasses or the goggles or the whatever, that lets you build the experience on them, not on a PC.
No, you build the experiences on a PC.
Oh, you do? Okay.
That target the app. Oh, yeah.
But you are trying to do the tooling.
Yeah.
But I think you need to paint a vision before you know what to build the tools. Like for me, the thing I've been struggling with AR is, what is the information workers app? You know, what is the word in Excel that needs a augmented reality?
Yeah. So, and of course, that is the question. That's a killer app. For me, the killer app I want the Terminator vision.
Right.
Right. I want to walk around and just see all this extra metadata.
Have your reality augmented.
That's right. I want, you know, I'm great with faces, but terrible with names. Help me understand as I approach this person, right? What they're remind me of their name and the last time we talked.
They had that in the 70s. It was called LSD.
Great.
Wasn't necessarily accurate information, but
if you made sure that the person you're talking to was taking it too, they didn't care.
yeah so you can think of LSD. I mean, the other part, the reason, one of the things I cared about was, I want useful information. I didn't want it to be just, you know, this stream of ads shouting it to you from all the places around you, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's therein lies the challenge, right? It's still, what's the business model? But I do think it's a very challenging space. Like every time I dig into industrial applications, like I've looked at some of the HoloLens applications where they're working on expensive machines, and the fact that the software can exactly that augment, these are the steps to do this maintenance, and then also keeps a detailed video record of them doing it correctly. Like when you're working on a $50 million machine doing a $5 million maintenance, a $5,000 headset isn't a big deal.
No, it's nothing.
Right. But that's very much that vertical industry. That certain verticals, that makes sense. It's not a consumer product.
Well, it was interesting too, because while I was there, we were definitely focused on the consumer space, but every one of our competitors had already transitioned to the enterprise space, right? HoloLens was enterprise and government, and Google Glass was enterprise, and Magic Leap, who knew what they were doing? Meta was very focused on consumers. And of course, you know, they always have been, right? Yeah, I mean, that's just the DNA of the company, right?
Product's always been.
And they changed their name to Meta, presumably to promote this idea of the metaverse, where they thought
everything was going.
Did they think they would be there by now?
Yeah. Oh, yes, for sure. And in fact, in many ways, they are. I mean, they are easily the number one VR headset, right? They keep pumping out better and better Quests, and the games are really great. They're a ton of fun, and they get better with every generation. But the thing that they kind of had a kind of unexpected hit in was the fitness apps.
And I
understand this myself, right? I mean, exercise has traditionally been something I do not enjoy. Because it's just boring,
right?
Mm-hmm. And so the nice thing about the Quest is, you know, you can do all kinds of amazing things that are actually good for you, right? You have fun, you're mentally engaged, and so they are easily the number one in that space. And then nobody's really done the AR thing yet. I mean, Apple Vision it's mixed reality, right? Essentially, it's goggles, right? Where they own every pixel, and then they use cameras to bring it in, so it looks like you're augmenting the world around you.
It's like MetaQuest too.
The Quest does that as well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, although, you know, the vastly different price point.
Yeah.
But nobody's gotten anything close to what you really want, which is, you know, an OS running on the glasses, right?
Mm. Yeah. Well, and I mean, you want it self-contained, but there's always that debate of, you know, what's actually necessary. I remember seeing the early prototypes of the HoloLens. They called the gargoyle, which is straight William Gibson, you know, the bridge quote. Because when you put that thing on, you look like a gargoyle, a painting, right? Like, it's just a set of cables running down your back. Like, it was a monster.
Well, and that was one of the tensions too, which is MR is a great kind of, stepping stone to AR, right? Because it helps you build out the experiences. But you are, by definition, limited to those people who are willing to walk around the world with those giant goggles on. Right?
And I guess that's what I was getting at when I asked if we were at the vision of the metaverse yet. I mean, yeah, you can put the goggles on and you can exercise and you can have fun and play games, but that's not where I live. I live in front of my monitor on my desktop computer. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I can't wear that thing for more than an hour at a time because it just hurts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, that's because of the weight. And it's because, I mean, for a lot of people, although this is less true over time as the graphics get faster, had trouble with sickness, right? And, you know, me, every time I put it on, the first thing I did was reflexively looked for my hands, right?
Yeah.
Where are my hands, right? And then, of course, after that, I wanted my keyboard right in front of me, as you as you correctly point out, Carl, right? I mean, but just to be clear, that stuff isn't for us, right? All of our reflexes that we've built up over a lifetime, Richard started in the back of a Radio Shack and has been building on those same muscles ever since.
Yeah.
This technology isn't for us, right?
Yeah.
We'll die, and the next generation will take the new technology and develop their own muscles around it, and they'll grow up with whatever it is. Now, I would argue that the VR stuff has not made it into a place where it's useful for, you know, a place where you live, as you put it, Carl. Right. That's a really good way to say it, right? It's not the place where people live. And I don't think it ever will be. I just don't think that that kind of bulk on your face is something that people want.
If I could, yeah.
But if we actually, when we get to smart glasses, not if, I believe it is absolutely a win. I think people will live in those for sure.
Yeah. I use Immersed with the Quest. Do you know about Immersed? Mm-mm. So this is something that you connect either via USB or Bluetooth to your computer. And you get your computer screen in a virtual world, and you can add multiple screens to windows and put them wherever you want. And also, you get to draw these portals, which are holes in the space-time fabric, right? You draw a little square where your keyboard is. You can see your hands. And so this is a really good thing. I love using it with a laptop in a hotel room if I really want to do some real work. Instead of, you know, being confined to the screen. It's got its drawbacks, but I like it. It's
interesting.
Pretty cool program. Jeff Fritz told me about it.
I really like that. I like that idea where you can like move your head over here, and that's where the hotel TV is, and you can carve out a spot in your that's a really clever way to do it, right?
Yeah, the quality for watching TV or video is not there, especially in low light, but it's getting better. It's a good idea. It's good enough for me to see the keyboard and mouse.
Well, and it's stuff like this. That's where the reason the reason I was excited about the technology is because, you know, you look at, you know, the web, and it's pretty much done, right? We know how to do things on the web, and there haven't been a lot of innovations there. And before that, the desktop has been done for a long time. And now you look at mobile, and it's done too, right? I mean, there's not a lot of innovations in terms of user experience and new ways of doing things. And so I looked at AR specifically, but VR too as kind of the next generation of user experience for computers, right? A new way of doing things. Turns out I was completely wrong. And I think everyone was. It turns out that the new way of interacting with computers is AI, is generative AI and LLMs.
Yeah. Before we jump into that, though, I really need to point out that Chris, for our listeners that don't know, was instrumental in the success of .NET Rocks. And he may not think so, but back when bandwidth was expensive, I was asking my friends, and Chris was one of them, hey, is there anything that you can think of to help us alleviate this bandwidth bill? And Chris was working at MSDN in Microsoft, and I think you said, I literally walked over to somebody whose name I can't remember and said, hey, can we help out Carl with maybe like a feed on our website? And that's exactly what they did. There was an alternate feed, RSS feed for the podcast on the MSDN website for a while. So thank you for that.
That was Sarah Williams, my boss at MSDN. And she was always a big fan of the community and helping out the community. And she was one of the actual, before she took over MSDN, she was one of the original evangelists at Microsoft, and kind of started up all the programs that we know and love. In terms of not just Microsoft, but how modern technology works in terms of developer relations and developer evangelism and that whole way of doing things. Sarah Williams was one of the people who invented all that for the Windows ecosystem. Yeah.
Back in the day.
There's another story about that feed, the MSDN feed. I can't remember what year this was. It must have been 2003, maybe 2003. So I did an interview with Miguel de Acasa, and this was back when, you know, Linux was the enemy and all of this stuff. Microsoft had not yet embraced open source or Linux or any of that.
Open source is a virus.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was deeply embedded in the corporate culture. And so they did not list that episode in their feed. It seems so silly now, right?
But that was the first time. So it's like, hey, this show didn't appear. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry about that.
Well, it's funny, too. Sarah was a shield for me when I joined because probably the most popular part of my website was the interview questions section.
Yes.
Where Microsoft interview questions, where I would just collect questions that people would ask, these silly questions. You know, it all started with why are manhole covers round? Descended into madness after that. And as soon as I joined Microsoft, somebody reached out to Sarah and was like, make him take all of that stuff down off of his website now. He works for us. To have him take it down or fire his ass. And she's like, nope. No, oh, that's his website. That's his personal stuff. Leave him alone. And
that's not how we do things.
That's right.
That's great. Great memories.
All right, let's take a break.
Yeah, we'll be right back after these very important messages. Hey, .NET 6 is going to reach the end of support this November, and now is the time to upgrade. .NET 8 is well supported on AWS. Learn more at aws.amazon.com/.NET.
Unborn babies may kick their mother 30 times an hour, making moms wonder, is that a karate champion in there? Well, one thing she won't wonder about is finding a great doctor at one of our 65 convenient Bay Area locations. Stanford Medicine Children's Health.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And we're back. This is .NET Rocks. I'm Carl Franklin. That is Richard Campbell.
Hi.
And that is our friend Chris Sells. And just before we jump back in, I got to remind you that if you don't want to hear those ads, you can get an ad-free feed by becoming a $5 a month patron at patreon.dotnetrocks.com. Chris, before I derailed the conversation, you were talking about AI as sort of the next thing that you were getting into, but you're retired now. So how does AI sort of fit in your post workday life?
Yeah. So, like I say, I retired in June. And before that, I spent a year as head of product at a little startup doing generative AI and dev tools. And it was honestly, it was an opportunity I could not turn down. Steve Yeagy from Amazon Cloud and Google Cloud kind of drug me into it. And the name of the company is SourceGraph, and they build a search product, which they have been doing for 11 years, and it's amazing and scalable, and you know, millions of lines of code and hundreds of thousands of separate repositories, all instantly available at your fingertips. And what they did was they took all of that search ability, that because they could not only can they do like literal search and regular expression search, but they do semantic search. They really understand your code. You can configure it so it knows about your C# code and your Dart code and your Java code and your Python. It knows. It has semantic knowledge, right? It knows the types and the relationship between the types. And you can navigate in their product. And so it takes all of that semantic knowledge, and they built out a product called Cody. And SourceGraph Cody is an AI coding assistant that lives in your IDE. It works in all of the JetBrains IDEs. It works in Visual Studio Code, and it does chat, and it does, you know, commands, and it does, you know, auto completions, and it does all the things you would expect, but it does it in an environment where for the enterprises with all of those hundreds of thousands of repositories and millions of lines of code, it brings those and that understanding of that into your chats, right? Into your use of the AI. And just, I mean, that's how I spent, I spent about the last year of my career. And then in June, I was, I did the math and figured out how long I'd been in this career. And I thought maybe it's time to take a deep breath, right? Step back, do something else. You know, I've been super lucky. I've gotten to do amazing things in my career. And I looked back over my career and I thought, you know, I don't want to jump back into some, you know, executive role. I don't want to jump back into some high level PM role. I've done that enough. Yeah. I really miss Carl. You and I are on the same page. If I don't write enough code in a week, I start to get itchy. Right. Yeah. And it's been a long time since I've had a job where writing code was part of it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I look back over my career and I thought, where was I having the most fun? Right. Well, you know, maybe I can start doing that again. Right. And it was very much working on the Flutter team.
Yeah. Hmm.
But a bunch of the stuff that I would do evenings and weekends, right, where I would, you know, go and give talks or be on podcasts and talk about the technology, or where I would, you know, build libraries and samples and kind of, you know, help fix developers lives, you know, more directly, as opposed to, hey, let me understand their requirements and motivate the PMs, you know, that work for me to go and blah, blah, blah. Right. I mean, it was more direct. And in fact, I invented the routing package that Flutter uses and the Flutter team now owns and is kind of their default experience. And that kind of stuff was all evenings and weekends. And I thought, maybe if I could do that again. And so I sent some emails out to some of my friends on the Flutter team. And now I'm up to my eyeballs building AI-related things for the Flutter and Firebase team. You know, you'd never know I was retired based on the amount of work I've been doing lately. But it's been all hands-on. Last week, I was in New York giving a talk on something called the Flutter AI Toolkit, which is something I've been building with Google, which is all about, hey, you want to take, you know, a Flutter widget and that is a whole AI chat, multimodal AI chat, pluggable LLM, out of the box support for the Google LLMs. You drop it into your app and then you hook it up to the data in your app and you hook the output out so that you can consume it in your app. Mm. And suddenly, bang, you can take any app and just make it better by, you know, this interaction with AI. And what I've seen is, and I wanted to build the simplest possible demo for this talk. So I wanted a recipe app, right? I started classic. With, it's just a list of recipes. That's all it is. And right. You can add them and edit them, right? It's a CRUD interface over your recipes.
You can scale them, obviously. This is the best thing about a recipe app. Yeah,
you can search them, whatever, right? And so it's just the barest minimum thing.
So classic.
But then you just drop in the chat and you hook up the data and you can start seeing things like, oh, these are my food preferences. Can you know, give me a version of that recipe substituting all the things, or go and, you know, give me a recipe from your training set that matches my, you know, food preferences, and, you know, I'll take a picture of what's in my fridge and my cupboard, or I'll take a picture of, you know, a recipe card that my grandma gave me and, you know, parse all that and give it to me in structured way and show it as a Flutter widget in line with the conversation and press a button and boom, now it's in your database. And
so cool.
All of these features where, you know, that you get by just dropping in an LLM and having a normal conversation in a multimodal way and just doing a little bit of input and output between the data in your app and the data in this chat. And suddenly you get an app is 10 times more powerful,
right?
Because it does, the LLM is implementing all of these features. Mm. That's the amazing thing.
And I like it from it's a feature extender, right?
That's
it's
right.
Really a new UX. Mm-hmm. To the way that you build software. I think it's not an app unto itself. It's just this ability to make an app way more compelling. It really kind of answer hard questions like, what substitutions can I make here? Or
that's right. And it's got because it's been trained on the entire internet, not only, right, does it have all of the Stack Overflow in it if I want to generate code, but it's got all of the recipes from all of the recipe sites around the internet in it. And so I can just say, give me a recipe with X, Y, and Z, and it just knows.
Yeah.
Right. And then you can tell it, oh, and, you know, behind the scenes, you can do some, you know, prompt engineering so that the recipes come out in a structured JSON format so your app can parse it And you can add a little button that says, here, bring this over to my database. Or when you're doing the output, you do a little post-processing on what the user has entered to enable RAG, right?
Right.
Retrieval augmented generation. Let me look up recipes from the current database and plug those in as appropriate and send those as input. I mean, it is so amazing how a little bit of glue with this fundamental building block, and suddenly you get all of these features that now as an app dev, I mean, just that one feature, right? Before LLMs.
Right.
Of let me scan a recipe card from my grandmother's, you know, stack of recipe cards.
Yep.
Right. That would have been, I don't know, six engineers for a year.
Right.
Yeah. Well, using OCR, you could do it, but you have to do a lot of logic to figure out what's what.
Well, except for my grandmother handwrites all of her recipe cards, right? Good luck with OCR and that. Whereas I can hand it to the LLM and it just works. I don't have to do, in fact, I don't even, as an engineer building the app, I don't have to do anything. That's just a feature that comes along out of the box because we're using LLMs. And that's why I say, as you, you know, I thought the next way that we were going to interact with computers was going to be these, you know, 3D interfaces, user interfaces. And it turns out that no.
It's a text box.
It's a text box, right?
Right. I mean, I would also argue they had the breakthrough. Right. Like we're still looking for the AR breakthrough.
Yeah, that's right.
I think
ChatGPT was the killer app.
Yeah, right? Was the breakthrough. Yep. That was the breakthrough. And that opened the door to a bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. They're not mutually exclusive. I think AR will benefit hugely by the context sensitivity, likely next behavior, probabilistic behaviors that these language models have. Like all of that will make that product experience better. Once we find the breakthrough that's going to make people care, because
and environment generation, right? I mean, let the LLM build up an environment around you. And in fact, I don't know if you've seen this. They actually, I think it was the DeepMind team at Google. They have got trained a model that will generate as you move around. They will generate 30 frames a second of Doom. Meaning they've trained it on Doom. It's not using the game engine. The game is not loaded or running.
You just discovered a new use for all the old shopping malls that are abandoned. We can go play Doom in them. It's so cool.
Yeah, I mean the potential for generative AI, and that's one of the points I covered in my talk. The core difference, because of course we've been doing AI for long enough, decades long enough, we've now had been through two AI winters, right, is what the AI research community calls them. We've been doing it for a long time. We've benefited, right? But there's all kinds of amazing stuff we got from AI. But generative AI is the first AI that will give us new content, right? Was before it was like, here, let me give you some content, you analyze it, and you know, you tell me, you know, is a cat or a dog, or you tell me, you know, the next number might be a six, whatever. But this is the first time where you can actually give it some parameters and have it generate anything language-like. It doesn't have to be a human language. It can be code. It can be JSON. It can be music. Images. It can be anything that is kind of has a description that you can run through an LLM. It is amazing.
Well,
and of course, images. Carl, you bring that up, right? Being able to
the multimodal.
Generate stable diffusion and generating images. It is a completely different way to interact with a computer.
There's a challenging step for your recipe app. Tell me what this will look like when it's cooked.
Ooh.
Well, actually, that's part of it, right? Yeah. Being able to say, hey, and now give me a picture of what this recipe is.
Yeah. Did I, or, you know, take a photo. Did I make this right? Like, is that?
There's that other thing. Being able to say, nah, maybe not. Yeah. Man, that's not how it's supposed to look.
I like the idea of taking the recipes from the internet plus all the comments and saying, you know, which version of this are people the most happy with, for example.
Yeah, well, one of the things the LLM can't do is taste it for you, unfortunately, right?
So, but it can read the comments and the ratings.
It has definitely given me several recipes that I do not think any humans would actually like to eat.
Okay.
Yeah, the testing backbone, that sort of, you know, generate evaluate cycle, to say, is this going to actually come out right? Like that, I think we're still tweaking and tuning on that. And certainly the latest Microsoft announcement for their Wave 2 has been a lot of this. How do we make the software iterate a few more times to tune itself per request?
Well, and that's the thing, right? Because right now we're doing AI in a way that is very much interactive, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, I go to a chat engine and I say blah, or I invoke a feature in my piece of software and it composes, you know, a chat request and goes to the LLM. We're moving to a place that is agent based. Right? Where you can say, hey, I want Cody, which is the name of, you know, SourceGraph's AI coding assistant. I want Cody to be a member of my team. I want to give it a badge, right, at my company. And I want it to look at all of the bugs that come in. And I want it to do that initial triage. Is this an actionable bug? Does it give me an error message? Does it tell me about expected behavior? Does it have a minimal repro? Can I reproduce the bug, right? If not, you know, automatically kick it back and ask for additional information, or or if you can reproduce it, take all of that information and then start doing like, hey, what might be causing the bug in the state of in my code base, and what are some suggested fixes, and stick all that in it, and then even maybe being able to say, and here's a PR, right, and now let me put that in the queue for the engineers to get to. So that's like 80% of the work, and it's all drudgery, right? Why do we have engineers do that, right? When we can have, you know, a software agent do that for us.
That could take a lot of that on.
That's right.
And certainly, you know, over on the Runas side, I've been talking to folks who are doing this with tech support tickets, where the tool now is analyzing the submitted ticket, and there's a bunch of, if it falls in a category of automated responses, like we'll push back the responses and potentially resolve the ticket on its own. But when it can't, actually then goes and does data gathering to further the process. So that by the time it actually lands on a person, it's been worked over. Like,
that's right.
Yeah. And it's just so that they're working on more meaningful work, less toil, more meaningful work.
Well, and it's interesting too, because you know, the term prompt engineer, right, got a bunch of chuckles from people.
Prompt engineer and crypto bro were said in the same voice, right? Like, that's the problem.
But here's the thing, right? If you, I mean, this was clear. I don't know if you, if you've seen, what Anthropic has been doing with Claude and, you know, that they have this cool feature where I think it's called Artifacts, where as it generates code, it pulls those out of the stream and sticks them over into, like, you know, the right hand side with the code thing. And then when it gets all the code, it actually runs it for you and you get a preview. Somebody leaked the implementation of that, and it read like, you know, a spec that a PM would put together and hand over to an engineer and say, can you build this for me? Right? The amount of detail that you get, it's like how you would talk to a human and get them to do it. You, essentially, people have switched from writing programs in code to, or they're switching to writing them in English. Here's what I want. Right. Go and give me a thing. And the beauty of that is everyone speaks their language, right? I mean, suddenly anyone that can write a precise or reasonably precise description of what they want can get it, and they don't need an engineer to do it.
Now, I like LLMs on both ends, where you just write a quick set of bullet points for what you want. It turns it into fancy prose to ask the person for it, who then uses an LLM to strip out the fancy prose to get the bullet points of what you want.
It's funny you say that. Yeah.
It's like, I don't want to read all this. Summarize it for me.
There have definitely been instances where I'm like, hey, I need a proposal. I need a performance review. I need a statement of work. I need this long drawn out document, right, to fulfill a requirement. But, you know, really I just have the data that I care about in bulleted form. You know, let me let the LLM do that first pass.
To dress it up.
Yeah. And then of course, you know, it's never good enough Right. No. You have to go through and edit it. And
but it's easier to edit than create. So, yeah. You know.
Well, and that's the beauty, right? I mean, it's always easier to subtract things out or edit, as you say, than it is to stare at a blank piece of paper and go, now what should I do?
How do I start this? Yeah.
So you as soon as you talked about Doom and AR, and I made the joke that, you know, there's a good way to repurpose all these closed shopping malls. It was a fun joke, but it just won't leave my brain. Like, AR requires real space, you know, whereas VR, I can see us getting close to the Ready Player One kind of circular walking, you know, pad that he was using in there too.
No, those are real things. Like I've been on one of those.
Yeah, so I remember they were the real things years ago. But
there was a game on the HoloLens where the aliens were attacking, but they come through your walls.
Oh, yeah.
So that mapped your surfaces, and you'd literally see a crack appear on the wall, and the alien would pop out of it.
And Quest has the same thing now.
Yeah.
It's so really cool. But AR requiring real space and VR not. So what's the story there? Do you think, okay, so here's a good AR app, the Pokemon Go app, right? Mm-hmm. Hugely popular, requires real space.
I would say that app is the only successful AR app.
Right.
Yeah, arguably.
Because GPS anywhere, you can put these things anywhere. Yeah. But what about, taking an existing space and mapping AR around it?
Actually, one of the best VR experiences I ever had was I was in Vegas, and they had taken a 2,000 square foot space, and they gave you a gun, right, a plastic gun, so you had something to pull the trigger on. They gave you the goggles, and they put the computer in a backpack on your back, right? So you were now a soldier going into battle. And you went with a bunch of other people, and you could see them in this virtual world. And they would march you around through the hallways and stairways and blah, blah, blah in this virtual world. And the way they did it, it felt like a huge, vast space. But they were just super clever about, using the 2,000 square feet and reusing it. And definitely, if you've got that kind of space, you can build some amazing things. All that said, I'm not sure I would be super excited about going up and down the stairs in an abandoned mall with goggles on my face.
Yeah, as long as you could see it. Yeah. Let's face it, being in Vegas itself is augmented reality.
Yes, very much so. remember, I used to play Own This World.
Yes.
Right before the game went away. And at one point, I actually owned the world. Because I leveraged using the road trip to collect as many, the whole world's cut up into squares.
Right. He was so antisocial, sitting up in the passenger seat the whole time, not talking to any of us, just playing Own This World.
What the hell is Own This World? I don't know what you're talking about.
It's long gone. But literally, I was always Pokemon fascinated with GPS type games, right? Games where your locale mattered, right? I did some geocaching and that kind of thing back in the early days. And Own This World was an interim game, was a game in a period there that was fun. But you mentioned Pokemon Go, because after Own This World went away, I started looking for a new game, and I found a game called Ingress. And Ingress is actually the precursor to Pokemon Go, because the big piece of data that made Pokemon work were the Ingress location sites. So this was a game about, aliens invading sort of thing, but are they beneficial or not? And so you picked a side. Are you working for them or against them? And what they were mainly doing was using GPS to mark up significant locations in communities, because those would become nodes in Ingress.
Yeah.
Well, when Pokemon Go appeared, it's from Niantic, the same team, and they basically use the data set from Ingress to create all the locations where the Pokemon appear.
Wow.
So it's just, you suddenly had this valuable GPS data set of curated locations that they had carried to other games. That I stopped playing all of those because who's got the time?
Patrick Hines plays Pokemon Go.
It's one of those quiet, you'd be surprised, lots of people play. It's a quiet little obsession, especially for travelers, because there are Pokemon that are specific geographies.
Well, there are lots of abandoned buildings now because of COVID, right? Office space is very cheap right now. You can't give these buildings away in some cases, and certainly shopping malls aren't going anywhere, but they're at least in my neck of the woods, all but abandoned. And, you know, everybody's trying to think of something to do with the shopping mall. What do we do with the shopping mall? And it just kind of occurred to me that maybe some sort of AR future thing, I don't think it would work now, might work with a HoloLens, but, you know, I don't know. Just sort of occurred to me.
It's an interesting idea to just have a safe, like build a soft walled space so people crash into stuff, they're not hurt.
Yeah.
And you use AR to make it into whatever game you want to play at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's about it. Chris, you got anything else that's on your mind that you want to talk about?
Well, the other thing that has been fun for me, as I re-engage with, you know, the kind of the most fun job I had in my life, but from a, you know, from a, essentially I've been kind of doing DevRel related work, which, you know, has always been my heart and soul anyway. I have been working with Rory Blythe, your old friend.
Wow. He told me that. Yeah.
And it has been a ton of fun. I mean, I have reconnected with the Flutter team, and you know, I went to that conference last week, and I couldn't walk 5 feet without, oh, hey, how you doing? How you been? Yeah. Right. That's been fantastic. So I have a lot of friends there, and the community is wonderful. And I just really love Flutter, all around, not just the tech, but just then
a nice community.
That's right, for sure. But then I happened to be hanging out with Rory a little bit, and I'm like, hey, you know, you want to do some Flutter work with me? You know, and he actually, when I wanted to have like an existing app that I could drop chat into, because, you know, what's the point of helping people build whole new, brand new standalone chats, right? Yeah. Those exist. The vendors already have them. But being able to take your existing app and drop in a chat, I think that would be super useful and helpful. But I needed, for my talk, I needed an app. I'm like, will you build this for me? Mm. And he did. I mean, that was the app I used. He built that initial recipes app for me.
That's awesome.
Cool. He and I have been doing some fun work together, and it's just been really great to reconnect with Rory too.
And I miss him. I keep in touch with him on text and stuff. And apparently we were going to, he had another crazy idea to do something, and we almost had a meeting about it, and then it kind of dropped by the wayside.
It's happened.
I can't even remember what it was right now, but he's just full of good ideas.
It was, he was using LLMs to build, actually Rory has been using generative AI for like 5 or 6 years, using kind of pre-ChatGPT oriented technology. And he is an amazing prompt engineer, right? He really knows how to make an LLM sing and dance. Mm. And so I've learned a ton of really cool tricks from him. And it's all from using this technology prior, where you had to be super specific, and he's built whole command systems and he was using that to build up the rules for the world for a tabletop RPG that he wanted to run us through. So
fantastic. Yeah, that's what it was. It was a role-playing game.
Sounds like a show.
We could do a show with him. It would be fun to have him back.
You totally should reach out to Rory. He's the best.
He's the best. I miss him. I miss the blog too. I miss Neopoleon. I understand why he had to shut it down, because people weren't taking him seriously as a developer, but man, I miss him.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
He's a great dev. I mean, he picked up Flutter in like a week, and he's been doing great stuff. So it's been really great to work with him.
Yeah.
He is the one who coined using Objective-C as Stockholm Syndrome.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And he still loves it.
He's okay with Stockholm Syndrome, apparently.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, Chris, it's been a gas, and we'll have to keep in touch every so often.
For sure, happy to. All right, see you guys later. We have to do this, right? I mean, eventually you'll catch up with the present, right? You'll have show 2024, and then you'll be podcasting from the future.
That's right.
Those are the ones.
We'll be making predictions. Yeah.
That's right. That's where that. I want to make sure I'm on those shows.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, thanks again, Chris, and for you, dear listener, we'll see you next time on .NET Rocks.
.NET Rocks is brought to you by Franklin's Net and produced by Quap Studios, a full-service audio, video, and post-production facility located physically in New London, Connecticut, and of course in the cloud. Online at pwop.com. Visit our website at dotnetrocks.com for RSS feeds, downloads, mobile apps, comments, and access to the full archives going back to show number one, recorded in September 2002. And make sure you check out our sponsors. They keep us in business. Now go write some code. See you next time.
Did you know that nearly twice as many people are hospitalized for COVID than the flu? That's why it's important to stay up to date with your COVID vaccine, especially if you're at high risk or over the age of 65. This year, you have a choice. Ask your pharmacist or doctor about a non-mRNA option. Get yours today. Visit choosenovavax.com to find a vaccine near you.
Discover your dream home at the Vineyard Collection 2 in beautiful Livermore, California. Nestled in the heart of wine country, these stunning new homes offer up to 3,490 square feet of luxury single-story living. With spacious floor plans, modern amenities, and a breathtaking location, the Vineyard Collection 2 is the perfect place to call home. Visit PonderosaHomes.com for more information. Cal DRE 01257567.